Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. In this episode, Cancer Network's Tim Cortes spoke with Dr. Diane Simeone of Moores Cancer Center at University of California, San Diego Health about the efficacy of daraxonrasib among patients with metastatic pancreatic cancer in the Phase 3 RASolute 302 study. Their conversation also touched upon the additional next steps for driving further improvements in the pancreatic cancer field.
Just to start off, these OS results have garnered a lot of attention from everyone across the oncology spectrum and even in the mainstream. What were these OS findings and why are they so significant?
As you know, pancreas cancer has been really a recalcitrant cancer to treat. And we've struggled to move the needle with novel therapeutics. And in fact, not very much beyond standard cancer. And chemotherapy, in which we have two different flavors or combinations, both FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine and Abraxane, that are kind of the workhorses of therapeutics for patients. Although I will say a couple of years ago, we had the POLO trial, which showed for patients who have BRCA mutant pancreas cancer that they can have outlier responses to platinum-containing regimens along with PARP inhibitors. And it has been a challenge to target KRAS in a meaningful way, just because it's been previously thought to be an undruggable target. Clearly, with some smart chemistry and determination, there have been a number of new approaches to make novel KRAS targeting drugs. And with the new agent, daraxonrasib, that was produced by Revolution Medicines, they have now shown the results of their Phase 3 RASolute 302 clinical trial that was used to evaluate this agent in the second-line setting. And by that, I mean patients who already had been treated with standard chemotherapy. And here they were either given the anti-RAS therapeutic, which was an oral agent, once a day, comparing that to whatever they were on standard of care chemotherapy. And there the results were quite significant in that it about doubled the overall survival rate in the second line setting, which was 13 months versus 6.7 months. And so that's a huge benefit for patients. And of course, these are patients with metastatic pancreas cancer, patients that already have tumor that has spread to multiple organs. And unfortunately, you know, those have been really tough patients to treat. And that's about half of pancreatic cancer patients that come in the door when they present. We still haven't had effective early detection strategies for pancreas cancer, although I think we're starting to really move the needle in that space. And that's a separate thing to talk about. But certainly for patients we're seeing in the clinic every single day, this is really impactful in improving their length of life and hopefully the quality of life.
That was phenomenal. Thank you. When was the last time you remember seeing a result that maybe garnered this much attention or that was such a big leap in pancreatic?
I mean, these are very compelling results. The other place you occasionally see results like this, interesting, are patients who are BRCA patients that respond to platinum containing agents and PARP inhibitors. And granted, it's just a subset of those patients, but I have seen patients with metastatic cancer that in that setting can live many years while responding to those regimens. So there, it's smaller subsets, it's more outlier kind of responses. This is something that can apply more broadly to pancreatic cancer patients. About 93% of pancreatic cancer patients have an oncogenic KRAS mutation. It's the most common mutation in any human cancer. Of course, we know there are different kinds of KRAS mutations, and there is work being done to develop. And we already know there are agents that are in clinical trial now that target specific KRAS mutations. This is a pan-RAS inhibitor that had these results. So I think it opens up a new frontier for patients. It's not curative, and obviously that's really where we're going for, but I think there will be an explosion, and there already is an explosion of new ways to target KRAS. This is one way that was deployed here, along with different combinations that will be used with KRAS drugs to try to further push the needle in improving overall survival for patients.
That's phenomenal. You spoke about KRAS a lot. And it, for a while, it was considered notoriously undruggable. But this inhibitor kind of does drug KRAS. So what about this agent is able to do that?
Well, I think it was just kind of a nifty understanding of the three-dimensional structure of KRAS, and then a natural product-based small molecule was used to remodel the surface of cyclophilin A. And there's a beautiful paper that was published in Science in 2003 outlining the chemistry around this, but it basically was able to utilize a very shallow pocket and develop a targetable approach using that. And there are all kinds of interesting new chemistries and technologies that are rolling out this kind of approach. There are also novel degraders and glues that are being created. So I think there's a lot of interest in targeting KRAS. Of course, pancreatic cancer has kind of been the holy grail, but also important in a subset of patients with lung cancer and colon cancer.
Thank you for that. I saw that UCSD does have the Resolute trials. Have you treated patients with this?
I personally haven't, because since I've been cancer center director, I'm not seeing cancer patients. I'm seeing a smaller cohort of patients. But our center, which enrolls 40% of all pancreatic cancer patients on clinical trials, which I think is among, if not the highest in the country, we have enrolled a large number of patients on this trial. I don't know where we are in rank order nationally, but I know it's right near the top. And of course, patients are demanding having access to these. So we do have patients flying in from around the country to join in the clinical trials that we have here.
That's phenomenal. Can you speak at all to the toxicity of the agent? I know that rash, diarrhea, and nausea are kind of the most common DREs.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like many therapeutics, it's a balance of risk-benefit, and we know the benefit. We've talked about like the significant improvement in overall survival. These drugs are not without significant side effects, and there was actually a pretty compelling interview of Ben Sasse in the New York Times a couple of days ago, and if you saw the picture of Ben, and honestly, I have to really applaud Ben for his bravery in speaking out. You know, he had visible evidence of what that rash looks like. So I think as we continue to try to advance this space with RAS therapeutics to enhance the performance of these agents alone in combination and mitigate the side effects so that they're easier for humans to tolerate, I think that's critically important. I don't think we're ready to put RAS therapeutics in the drinking water yet. I've heard people say, well, let's just give it to everybody. And, I think to espouse general use of these reagents is a little bit premature, because we need to really understand how they perform. You could see a leaning to try to push these into the earlier stages of cancer. And of course, that'll be important in both the neoadjuvant setting, where we have, you know, maybe about 15 or 20% of patients that are operative candidates that we may want to shrink their tumors to make it more favorable to resect them, or even in what's called the adjuvant setting, where we resect a patient's tumor. And then if we want to make sure there aren't any cells lurking around that we can't see, to treat with RAS therapeutics. And of course, and I'll be talking about this at the AACR meeting, we know there are patients at high risk for pancreas cancer, be it people with the family history, certain mutations, or even cystic tumors. And I think we're starting to move into the space where we may be able to do chemo prevention trials, but we have to be very thoughtful about which agents we use and how we deploy them in a thoughtful way.
Thank you. You just touched on a lot of my next question here about Ben Sasse and the risk-benefit considerations specifically. What do those conversations typically look like, where you have an agent that has this massive leap in survival, but also the toxicity might be kind of intense?
Yeah, I mean, we're the trusted partner to the patient, so we have to always be open and honest and let them know all the data and help them make an informed decision. Certainly, we also work very hard with other specialties to try to effectively treat. And as we continue to use these therapies, we learn to mitigate some of the side effect profiles with maybe more nuanced dosing and things like that. you know, I think Ben's interview was telling, because every month of life, especially if it can be a high quality month, that gives people time to interact with their children, to see somebody graduate, to see someone get married. Time is precious. Actually, time is the most precious thing we all have. So to try to provide time for people to further enjoy their lives, that's so, so important.
Thank you for that. I'm sure when a drug like this kind of hits headlines and people see the big jump, it's like all the patients in the world with the disease kind of want it and they send messages. I know it's not approved yet, but as someone in leadership, as the director of the Moores Cancer Center, what's it like trying to distribute or get supply and distribute this to patients when it becomes available to everyone?
I'm not treating cancer patients myself right now, but when we opened this trial at my last institution before I came here to be the director at Moores Cancer Center 2 years ago, we were one of the first sites, and patients, you know, they're lining up around the corner to have access to this. And, you know, the good thing is RevMed is not alone in making these drugs. There are now, you know, at least 15 or 20 companies that are bringing new RAS therapeutics into the clinical arena. The quicker and sooner that we can get these agents available for patients, that's going to be really, really important. And just like any therapeutic, so far we have our many therapeutics in the pancreatic cancer space. It does, you know, we don't see cures with this treatment. And we're also going to need to know what to do next with patients after they receive the benefit from this therapy. If their tumor starts to outsmart the therapy, what are the next combinations? What other kinds of therapies are out there besides this class of therapies? So there are lots of novel therapeutics going after pancreatic cancer in other categories. Certainly, you know, we're still trying to turn this, what we would call a cold tumor, you know, immune resistant tumor to immune responsive tumor. So there's a lot of work in that space. There are also precision oncology therapies that we talked about. There are certain portfolios, mutations in pancreas cancer that may be uniquely responsive to certain classes of drugs. And so I think as we work across the landscape, an important thing is to make sure all pancreatic cancer patients get germline testing and tumor sequencing, because we don't really give patients the optimal opportunity to have access to a clinical trial and might be a groundbreaking therapy for them. So that's on us as a field. We work very hard here at the Moores Cancer Center to make sure every patient has tumor sequencing. But if you look across the United States, I think there's still lots of patients that don't get their tumors sequenced, and they may not know what might be the best therapy that is within their grasp. So that's important messaging for us to get out there too, for all the doctors that are seeing patients with cancer. Really push to make sure you get germline testing and tumor sequencing on every single patient.
What are the logistical obstacles, or maybe what needs to be put in place for that to be able to happen, for more patients to be able to be genetically tested?
Yeah. So, you know, number one is awareness of what national standards are. And I always refer to the NCCN, which is kind of a national arbiter of guidelines. And the NCCN has assembled teams of experts across each cancer to define what the treatment and also testing guidelines should be. I'm a strong believer in germline testing for cancer risk, where we still are incompletely identifying who is at already elevated cancer risk across the United States. And now germline testing is recommended for many cancer patients. And then tumor sequencing, that's really just, you know, making sure that not only physicians, but patients are their own advocates and making sure that their tumor gets sequenced, that they have that information in hand, that they ask their doctors what their options are. We always recommend getting a second opinion, especially recommend, if possible, to be seen at a comprehensive cancer center where you have a multidisciplinary team that's going to help guide you through what can be a complex journey with a new diagnosis of cancer.
Phenomenal. Thank you for that. one of my last questions here. Developmentally, what do these findings with the KRAS inhibitor mean for the future landscape of PDAC development?
Well, this has been a holy grail kind of thing where people have wanted to target KRAS, but it's really been a challenge. So this definitely is a breakthrough. I've been kind of beating the drum about all of the drugs are going to work better if we have smaller, earlier stage tumors that we're treating. So you can see the pretty dramatic effect in patients with metastatic cancer. And unfortunately, that's still half of patients who come in the door with pancreas cancer. But what if we were applying this therapy to early first stage cancer? I think the results would be even more profound, and that's where we would start to drive the cures. So if we can have an investment in early detection that is partnered with these advances in therapeutic regimens, I think that's where the magic's going to happen, and we're going to get ourselves out of this 13% survival rate and really try to push up the needle for pancreas cancer. It is long overdue.
I know the last time we spoke, it was about the PROCEED Consortium. So yeah. How do initiatives like that kind of pair with developments like this to really push the needle forward?
Yeah, I think the investments need to happen in parallel. We've talked before about the fact that only 6 to 8% of all cancer funding is on early detection and prevention. And we've also talked about the fact if we can find early stage one pancreas cancers and resect them, that the cure rate is at least 83%. So I think downstaging of cancers, better understanding who's at risk. With PRECEED, we have the world's largest longitudinal study of people at high risk for pancreas cancer, about 12,000 individuals at 65 centers worldwide. That's a platform to really figure out what early detection tools work the best, and then see where we can have an opportunity to disseminate those early detection tools more broadly. If I can find a stage one cancer, it might be it doesn't need any treatment, and that's the best option. But if we find a stage two cancer and we resect it, and then we can do a follow-up, a short treatment with a KRAS inhibitor, you know, that could also be now become a very highly curative situation where we go from a 40% survival with stage two to a 90% survival. So I think those two things really sprinting in parallel, that's what we need for this disease.
That's really great. Those are all the main questions I have. Is there anything else you might want to say about this development or just in general?
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to patients who put their trust in us and understand we're really trying to work with them to help make advances. But it's really the patients that do a lot of the work and going on these trials, having to come in for extra visits. And, you know, they really are the unsung heroes, as are all the patients who have that have passed from pancreas cancer where we haven't had the answers and kind of the strife their families have gone through. So this is a cancer that really needs to summon a lot of resources and increased effort to tackle it. And I think what we talked about today with the RevMed findings, this is an important piece of the puzzle.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.